New safety rules from the Food and Drug Administration may affect those of us who buy our food at farmers markets and will certainly affect those who sell there. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We're going to start the hour with a conversation about food safety and new rules that govern how produce is handled. Angela Shaw is an assistant professor of food safety at Iowa State University, also with ISU Extension. She'll fill us in and we'll talk about some food safety precautions home gardeners should consider. Horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here today to answer your questions about your yard and garden. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and although your garden plot may be more of a mud puddle right now, or maybe it's even covered in snow this morning, horticulturist Richard Giron will be here to answer your questions about your yard and garden in a few minutes. But we're going to start the hour with a conversation about food safety and new rules that govern how produce is handled. Angela Shaw is here. She's with Iowa State University Extension, and she's also an assistant professor of food safety at Iowa State University. Hello, Angela.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I am excited.
Well, the Food Safety and Modernization Act was signed into law in January of 2011. There have just been some changes to the law, some exemptions that have been announced, but most of us probably haven't been closely following the news about that law. So can you tell me why it was put into place?
Well, it was really put into place because we saw a big spike in the number of fruit and vegetable-associated outbreaks of illness throughout the United States. So the FDA, or the Food and Drug Administration, said, we have to do something. We have to put some regulations in place. So that was the basis behind it, just seeing a big spike over the past 10 years.
All right. And we're talking about the outbreaks of E. coli associated with spinach and some of those events.
Yes, the E. coli with spinach, Listeria and Salmonella with cantaloupe and lettuce. We've seen peppers. We've seen about everything in between being affected. So
when we think about those outbreaks, I think a lot of us associate them with large operations. Who is affected by these laws?
Well, the regulation is actually targeted towards some of our medium and large companies specifically, but recognizing that a lot of these large companies are composed of a whole bunch of smaller companies that actually supply to them. So the regulation is pushing back to some of our small producers. Now, the regulation does have exemptions for some of our very small growers. So specifically, they mention those that have gross incomes of $25,000 or less are exempt from this ruling. But in addition to that, they have some specific definitions of what food is, with some other regulations. And so we have a $300,000 annual sales, as well as a $500,000 annual sales or less being exempt for it, depending upon where they're actually servicing their produce to. So the $5,000 or $500,000 mark is those that are specifically going to directly to consumers. So you're going to the restaurants, you're going to the farmers markets, or those type of entities, they are exempt. But then they have this other category of $300,000 or less, and they don't have any specifics to the vineyard you're going to. So within the category of food, that also includes our soybean sales, as well as our fruits and vegetables, because they go underneath that category. So some of our Iowa-based companies need to be aware of that, our farmers, because if you're going for human consumption, then you may not be exempt from this ruling.
Okay, so it's time to carefully look at what the rules mean. What are some of the changes that might affect a farmer? How might a farmer have to change their operation?
Well, really, I tell people when they ask me about the ruling, it's just about good agricultural practices. I mean, they really want you to have good record keeping. They want to make sure that you're testing your water and your soil and have good parameters for sanitation, as well as training programs for your personnel. So to me, a lot of the ruling, it shouldn't affect a lot of our growers. It might mean that you have to do a little bit of tweaking and add some record keepings and some actual training events, but it shouldn't affect us very much.
So when we think about, you know, on this show, we talk about gardens, and a lot of us are people who shop at farmers markets and buy our produce there if we're not growing it ourselves. What kinds of things should we think about as consumers?
Well, from the consumer side, I mean, it's about knowing your farmer and your grower, whether that's a master gardener or what have you. And I always encourage consumers to ask some additional questions. Here at Iowa State, we offer a lot of educational options for our growers and our, and we ask our consumers to just ask them about some of their food safety practices they do on their farm. And I would say the majority of our growers, they do a wonderful job with producing, and they're willing to kind of just express how much they care about their the people that are eating their fruits and vegetables and things. So I just encourage our consumers to, you know, ask them, do they have an on-farm food safety plan? Do they have a training in place to make sure that their fruits and vegetables are safe?
What are some of the dangers with fruits and vegetables? I mean, again, when we think about the E. coli and the Listeria, we think about large operations. But on a smaller scale, what are some of the pitfalls?
Well, I always start off and say bacteria don't care size of a farm that you have. So some of the pitfalls that I really just see is when I go out to growers is if they're not using municipal water supply, then they might not be testing it. They might be using river water. And so a lot of those other sources that aren't tested regularly can have high levels of some of our fecal coliforms. And so from the name fecal, or that can be triggers for some of our E. coli and salmonellas and listerias. And the latest outbreaks that we've had have been associated with water, soil, and equipment. So not sanitizing equipment. So it's basic things that should be a part of a farm's practices that they found failure in. And those failures can occur whether you're a small grower to a large grower.
If we're thinking about our own gardens, do you feel like these are our dangers in our own gardens?
Well, they could be. But if you're supplying just to your family, then I would say that you still should be concerned with making sure things like your dogs and cats are out of your garden, because they do carry bacteria and viruses. But if it's just supplying to your own family, then there's the risk level for causing problems is a lot less than if you're going to like a farmer's market where you're actually distributing. And when I tell people that are going to farmer's markets, you know, you're a food manufacturer now. So you really have to take that seriously, because if you were to have a problem, then you can cause a lot of people to become ill.
Manure is obviously not only a danger, but also a great fertilizer for a lot of people. What are some of the rules that you need to follow to make sure that it is helping rather than hurting?
Well, I'm a big component of making sure that if you're using raw manure, and I think the majority of Iowans do such a great job with that, but using the 120-day rule for making sure that you have that gap between harvest time, which I think is a standard rule that a lot of people use. And if you don't use raw manure, then making sure you're properly composting. And here at Iowa State, we have a wonderful expert that specializes nothing but composting and is able to assist with, you know, how many turns and what temperatures you're supposed to reach to make sure that it's not a source of contamination, because it can be.
How about with food preservation? What are some of the dangers that we might want to think about if we want to store produce from our own gardens?
Well, when I think about food preservation, the most important bacteria I'm worried about is Clostridium botulinum. And Clostridium botulinum is our one major bacteria that likes no oxygen. So when you talk about putting any type of fruit and vegetable into a jar and closing off and removing all oxygen, that's when it becomes a problem. So properly heating or using acidity, so the addition of things like lemon juice and vinegars and things to reduce the pH is very, very important, as well as thinking about water activity. So water activity is the amount of of water that's available for bacteria to drink. So bacteria and viruses are, well, but bacteria specifically are just like us. They need food, they need water, and the majority of them need oxygen outside of this Clostridium botulinum. So when you talk about putting fruits and vegetables into a jar, you're giving them everything that they need. So, but they don't like it very acidic, and they don't like not having water. So if you're able to eliminate just those two factors, you significantly reduce your risk of having a foodborne illness or an outbreak associated with it. And once again, preserve the safe or preserve the taste this summer is another wonderful program here at Iowa State that we offer to our home gardeners to learn about preservation. And it's a whole online course that you can sign up for, and they have all those details there.
I think that for anybody who's new to canning, if you read about all of the things that can go wrong, it can be extremely intimidating. but do you feel that if you actually learn the process and follow the rules, that it can be a very safe practice?
Oh, yes. And we have a lot of experts around the state. So it's just a matter of reaching out to your Master Gardeners program, as well as your extension offices. And you can find women and men throughout Iowa that are pros at this, that teach me a lot of times when I go out to workshops on how to properly do it. I mean, we just have so much talent who do it safely. And it seems intimidating, but it's really not. I mean, if you follow the steps that are laid out, it's quite easy, and it's nutritious, and it's great for families. I mean, making sure that we're able to preserve our fruits and vegetables throughout the winter so that we are still consuming our recommended amounts.
Back to the Food Safety and Modernization Act, I think a lot of farmers and small producers in particular get really worried when there's new legislation like that. With the new rules that are in place, is this something that is going to be difficult, do you feel, for growers in Iowa to meet the standards?
I don't think it's going to be difficult for them to meet the standards, but it is with any new regulation, it does mean a little bit of addition of time and money sometimes. And so getting your head around that might be a bit of a challenge, but I don't see it out of the norm of what people are currently doing on their farms to cause a lot of problems.
All right. Angela Shaw, thank you very much. And stay with us. Of course, Angela Shaw with Iowa State University Extension. She's also an assistant professor of food safety at Iowa State University. Horticulturist Richard Giron is going to join us in a moment. We know we have plenty of moisture so far. We're going to talk about some of the other things that may be bringing up questions about your yard and your garden this spring. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or of course, you can always send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and now joining us is Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. And Angela Shaw is still with us. If you have questions about food safety, she's an assistant professor of food safety at Iowa State University. And you can join us with your questions about the plants in your life. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I'm sure we'll get lots of questions like this one, Richard, but we'll start with Matt's question. With the cool weather, I was wondering when I should uncover my strawberries. Can I go ahead and uncover them now, or should I wait?
I think I would do that either this weekend or early next week. I think they should be fine. It takes a few weeks for them to bloom after they're uncovered, so by then we should be around early to mid-May. So I'm guessing this weekend or early next week.
All right. And I finally got my spinach and lettuce in the ground a little bit late, but I'm feeling okay about that.
You should, because it's been awfully cold and awfully wet. And I would say most people haven't done much of anything in the garden right now. So
Well, especially those who have to shovel snow to get to
it. Yes.
All right. Let's get to the phones. Diane is on the line from Sunrise Beach, Missouri. Hello, Diane.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
We have an ornamental cherry tree that got borers a year ago, and we consulted with our nursery, and they gave us a spray that was supposed to kill the borers, which I think it has. But we waited until this spring to see what happened, and two of the three main branches appear to be totally dead.
Okay.
But the third one has leaves and flowers coming out. And our question is, should we prune off those two dead branches, and will more shoots come out from them?
Yeah, typically when you get borers, that's a pretty bad sign that the tree is in very poor condition or health. And so the long-term prognosis is not very good at all.
Uh-huh.
I would guess the entire tree may be dead in a year or two.
Okay.
But I would prune out the dead branches at this point and see what they do the next year or two.
Okay.
But I wouldn't be terribly optimistic.
Okay.
So.
Thank you very much.
All right, Diane, thanks a lot for your call. And you can join us at 866-780-9100. Bill is on the line next in Waterloo. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I had a question about grass seed. I've heard them. I like the idea of a thick yard to keep the weeds out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard you mention fescue. I was wondering the difference in texture and color of fescue versus bluegrass.
Okay. Well, with the fescue, you have the common fescue, which is rather coarse and very different than bluegrass. But on the other hand, you have these new improved turf-type tall fescues, which look very similar to bluegrass. So I think they're totally acceptable. Now, we typically don't mix bluegrass and tall fescue together. We typically don't, but you can if you wish. Tall fescue is a little bit more drought-tolerant than bluegrass, and so it might survive a year like last year better than bluegrass. But we can grow it quite successfully here in Iowa.
Okay. Could I plant as late as June 1st or seed it?
Well, is it a totally clean soil?
No, it'd be overseeding.
Overseeding. I would be shooting for, if you want to do it this spring, I would be shooting to do this hopefully maybe in late April, if possible.
Okay.
Okay. Right now, obviously, it's too wet.
Right.
And how do you intend to do that?
Just broadcast it, probably.
Okay. If you have existing grass...
Well, it was going to be all thatched and pretty tore up and
then
broadcast over that.
So what you could do is you could, right before you plant a seed, you could power rake the lawn.
Yep.
And that would kind of pull out the thatch and break the soil surface. Then you could sow your seed and then power rake it a second time. That's one way.
Yep.
Or you could core aerate the lawn.
Right.
Sow your grass seed. And then after that, drag the area with a drag mat or a piece of fencing to kind of work the seed into the soil. Either way works fine.
Okay, sounds great.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Bill.
Thank you.
You can join us at 866-780-9100, and Jody is on the line next in Maxwell. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a question for Ms. Shaw. Are there any dangers using collected rainwater for watering or irrigating your home garden?
We just were talking about that. So rain barrels is a concern from a food safety standpoint if you're using that rain for some of your ready-to-eat fruits and vegetables that are directly on the ground. And that's because there was a study that was done by Rutgers University that actually collected 220 rain barrels throughout the East Coast. And what they found was high levels of fecal coliform. So those are the bad bacteria, as well as I've taken some samples and I found salmonella and E. coli in them. And the reason for that is because we have a lot of our feathered friends that like to fly overhead. And so things like birds and runoff off of your roof that have squirrels and things, they all contain salmonella and E. coli. within their feces. And so we recommend that you use that rain barrel water if you're using it on non-ready-to-eat products that are on the ground. So that's fine for your flowers and your grass and all of that. But if you're talking about your lettuce and your cantaloupes and things like that, we say no.
Okay, what about if you use it like in a drip irrigation system or where you water the soil, or should you just not even go there?
Well, one thing if you're watering your soil is you're potentially causing your whole soil to be contaminated.
Ah.
So you could be just putting it and spreading it throughout and giving it time because, you know, throughout the Midwest and the nation, we have perfect conditions for bacteria to grow. So that's why we say even drip irrigation or even if you use any rise with any of your soils and things, you have potential for contamination.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, Jody, thank you so much for your call. And Jan in Iowa City has a related question. I have a feeling I know how this is going to go, but hi, Jan.
Hi there. I had this exact same question, and I'm kind of horrified because I've been using the rainwater to wash my produce, you know, for years, and I'm glad to learn the truth, but it's kind of scary.
Well, when you say that you're using it for wash water, now there was a study that was also done at Rutgers University to decontaminate it. So if you're using any sanitizers as well as bleach, they found that if you use a low concentration of chlorine bleach within it, it has to sit for 8 hours, though. I'm sorry. For it to actually inactivate some of those fecal coliforms they found as effective method. But if you're using a sanitizer, you have potential to kill what's in the water first before you're using it. But I have to say it takes a little bit of time for them to be effective.
How much bleach should I put in a 55-gallon barrel of water?
Well, the combination, I have to go back and look, but I believe it was just 50 ppms of it, which the equivalent would be, let me think. So if you said you have 50 gallons?
55 gallons.
55 gallons. What do we say? I would have to do my calculations to figure that one out. But
Jan, maybe you could. I'll put you on hold, and you can leave contact information with our phone producer, and we can get back to you on that. Does
Thank
that sound
you very
good?
Much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jan. And let's go now to Doug on the line in the Quad Cities. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I've got a question about using sawdust as mulch. I've got blueberries, and my sawdust is actually not fine sawdust. It's out of planers and joiners and whatnot, so it's more like shreds and chips.
Okay.
And I'm using mostly oak, walnuts involved in
good.
That.
Good, good.
And is it okay to use that to help acidify the soil by putting a 6-inch deep layer of sawdust around the base of the blueberry plants?
Well, it's a good mulch. I probably wouldn't use 6 inches, maybe around 3 to 4 inches. It doesn't really acidify the soil that much. What I'd be inclined to do is every spring go out with some sulfur or some ammonium sulfate and sprinkle that around the plant, because the sulfur in those two materials will lower the acidity.
So it's okay to use it for a mulch, though.
Right. One caution I have would be if you apply that, go out there periodically and see if the surface is crusting over, because sometimes it will if the wood chips are fairly fine.
Yeah, these are pretty coarse, so
okay.
That should be all right.
But just check, because if it crusts over, then when it rains, the water tends to run off and not soak through it.
Ah.
And if it is crusting over, kind of break it up with a rake or something.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And you can join us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, horticulturist Richard Giron and food safety expert Angela Shaw. So you're welcome to call with your questions about plants in your life, but also food safety questions as well. 866-780-9100, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Richard, you said 6 inches is too much mulch. Why can there be too much? What is the problem that causes?
Well, it may be difficult for the water to penetrate that mulch layer and not be the best thing. Also, maybe some of the roots might actually grow in the mulch layer, which isn't the best thing. So I would say more like 3 to 4 inches would be better.
Okay. Let's go to the phones again. Luann is on the line in Johnston. Hello, Luann.
Hi. Thanks so much for answering my question. I have two questions. When is a good time to put pre-emergent down?
Here in central Iowa, we're having a cool spring, so if you can put that down anytime in the next 2 weeks, you'll be fine. So anytime in the next 2 weeks.
Okay. And then when should we work on grub control?
Well, if you wanted to put on a grub product on your lawn as a preventative, I would probably do so in basically July. That should take care of it. You could put it on earlier, but I wouldn't. I'd be inclined to wait and put it on right before a rain in July. That would be fine.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for your call, Luann. We've got another lawn question here. David is on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, David.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is, I've got an established, long-established, but a little bit stressed yard. The other day, I thought it'd be nice to put a pre-emergence. I put 2603 down. And nice rain and stuff like that. But now that I look at the yard, I'd like to do some seeding as well. And I'm wondering how long I have to wait before I can put some seed down and aerate.
Okay, so you did actually put on a pre-emergent herbicide too.
Yeah,
okay.
I did.
Then you're going to have to wait until late summer.
Oh,
that would be mid to late August. And actually, mid to late August is a better time than spring. So.
Mm-hmm.
So I do it then. So I'll go ahead and keep the lawn well mowed. If you're still not happy in early August, go ahead and overseed in mid to late August.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. Is there snow on your lawn this morning?
Yeah, a little bit, but it's just pretty much disappearing now. So we're hoping and praying.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot for your call, David.
Okay.
All right. And you can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. John is on the line in Davenport today. Hi, John.
Hi. I have two questions, really.
All right.
My grandmother, by the way, you're my third favorite program on the public radio.
Well, thanks.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and you, and there's another I can't think of right now because I'm thinking of my questions.
All right. Well, what are your questions?
Well, first of all, I have an African violet. They were my grandmother's favorite plants, so I've been trying to raise them, and I've murdered several of them. This one's doing very well, but it's not blooming.
Okay.
The second question is that I have a Queen of the Night, which I've asked you about before, orchid cactus, and I have two starters leaves, and one of them is just sitting there doing nothing except staying green and alive, and the other one is putting out shoots, but they're long and spiky.
Okay, so should we start with the violet?
Well, right, as far as it not blooming, two things come to mind. The plant is not getting enough light.
I bought a light.
Okay. It doesn't need or want direct sunlight, but it needs bright light. That's important. The other thing is if we sometimes unintentionally over-fertilize, we encourage vegetative growth and inhibit flower formation. So if you do fertilize, be very conservative on that.
I think you've hit that one.
Okay. As far as Queen of the Night, I'm not sure why the one is not apparently doing much of anything.
Sits there looking pretty.
Well, I would be patient, and sometimes it does take them a while to get going again, so I would be patient on that. There's not much you can do beyond that. As far as the other one, make sure it has plenty of light so the growth is somewhat retarded, but beyond that, I can't think of much to do.
Okay, now I bought a plant light for the violet.
Okay.
The other one I'm using regular fluorescent light for the orchid cactus. Should I get a plant light for it?
No, that should be the fluorescent tubes should be fine if you have like a typical shop fixture that has two 40-watt tubes in it. That should be fine. Make sure the fixture is quite close to the plant within like 4 or 5, 6 inches.
Okay.
And leave it on for basically 12 to 14 hours per day.
Thank you very much.
All right, John. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Dennis on the line in Polk City. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I got a couple questions.
Okay.
The first one is I've planted two patches of potatoes now, and I usually don't plant this late, but I have. this year's been different, but I have about 8 inches of bean straw on one and 6 inches of straw on the other, and they are, with the potatoes, just almost like laying on the ground with the eyes up. I wonder if that's going to be an issue, because some of them have been in the ground for 2 weeks. Do I need to do anything or just let them go and see what happens?
Well, the concern would be it's been so cold and wet, and with the straw in place, it's going to retard the warming of the soil and possibly sprouting.
I understand that.
So that is a concern that that may cause them to rot. If you could, I might be inclined to remove that straw, if you could, this weekend, to allow the ground to warm up and maybe promote sprouting of the potatoes, and then put it back eventually when they come up.
Okay. I'll think about that. That wouldn't be too much of a problem to just pull it back on a warm. If I see like a window of a couple days where
right.
it might be kind of warm.
Yeah.
All right, and we need to take a short break here. We'll get back to your questions in just a moment. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension, and Angela Shaw is an assistant professor of food safety at Iowa State University. You can ask your food safety questions today as well. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Angela Shaw, assistant professor of food safety at Iowa State University. And you can join us at 866-780-9100. We're going to get to some email questions here. This is from Sandra. I just heard you reply to a woman about pre-emergence for grubs. When should I put down a pre-emergent for Asian beetles, those nasty things?
Well, there's not much you can really do on that. The thing about the Japanese beetles is in the juvenile phase, they are grubbing the soil. But even if you treat your lawn for grubs, it's not going to reduce the number of Japanese beetles because they come from other adjacent grassy areas like roadside ditches and pastures and other lawns. And so if you treat your lawn, it doesn't really impact the population at all. And they're good flyers, and so it doesn't really help with the Japanese beetles.
All right.
Unfortunately.
There is you and Donald Lewis and everybody has come up with so many different ways to say there's nothing you can do about them. But we
nope.
will continue asking, I promise. All right. Next up, Joan asks, lilacs, should I plant them now or in the fall?
I would plant them sometime in the next, let's say, 2 or 3 months. Spring is a good time. They're typically container grown or bald and burlapped, so I would typically do it yet this April or May. If they're bald and burlapped or container grown, theoretically you can do it basically in the entire growing season up until maybe mid-October.
All right, let's get back to the phones, and Ed is on the line. Hi, Ed.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Rhubarb. I live in down by Fairfield, and I have some white oak soil, basically clay, and not very good quality soil. But I have neighbors that have rhubarb, and they
mm-hmm.
just grow it like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I go out and dig up some of their clumps and bring them back and plant them, and they don't grow.
Okay.
They just kind of come up a little bit and maybe have a little thing as big as your hand or something comes up a little. And during the summer, they sometimes the bugs kind of get into them and eat the holes in the leaves. And I guess I really didn't even think that bugs ate holes in leaves in rhubarb. But in any event, I've put a little 10-10-10 fertilizer on them occasionally. They're kind of up on top of a little bit of a hill area where that's drained. But I just can't get them to go. And I dug them and tried them and planted them 3 or 4 times and didn't know if you had any thoughts, or is it a pH problem or a moisture problem or what?
Well, it may be a soil structure problem as far as how much clay and whatever you have. And so if you feel you have a fairly poor soil, a lot of clay in it, for example, what I would do is get some compost or some barnyard manure, maybe 2 or 3 inches, and work it deeply into the soil, okay? Really add that, incorporate that into the soil, and then make sure the site has plenty of sun, at least 6 hours of direct sun per day.
It's out and totally open, and it's actually about 25 feet from a gravel road, which has a lot of lime dust, so I'm hopefully thinking that some of the lime may have drifted over on that. I didn't know that would be a problem with lime.
I don't think the lime is an issue, but I would make sure you have good soil as far as a certain amount of organic matter in the soil. So maybe work in some compost or some barnyard manure. Really work it in well, and then go ahead and plant, and make sure you keep the plant well watered the first year. Do not harvest anything the first year. You can fertilize again maybe the following spring using like a 10-10-10. Again, do not harvest next year. Give it 2 full years to get established, okay? And again, water if necessary that second year. And hopefully by the third year, you'll have a nice, healthy plant, and you can harvest.
All right. Ed, good luck with that. Some people seem to be able to grow the most amazing rhubarb without even trying.
Right.
And then others of us
it just sets
struggle.
There.
Yep, exactly. We have another rhubarb question. This is from Karen in Iowa City. My boyfriend and I recently moved into a new home and noticed rhubarb plants growing next to our garage. I wondered how one knows if it's safe to eat. It grows quite close to the garage, and I wasn't sure if we should be concerned about the possibility of lead paint in our older home affecting the plant.
That can be difficult. But on the other hand, the positive thing is that plants don't readily absorb lead. Typically, you tend to get lead poisoning where you might have a leafy vegetable like lettuce or spinach, and then you have splashing, and you get splashing of the soil onto the foliage, and that's where you can have a problem. Or if you have small children and they play in the area, and they get it on their fingers and then stick their fingers in their mouth. So that tends to be the biggest concern as far as lead.
Okay. So you don't think they should be worried?
No, I don't think so, no.
No, I don't think so either.
All right. And Angela, we've got another question for you. This one's from Cindy in Cedar Rapids. Christy in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Christy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, what's your question?
In the fall, I like to shop the church bazaars and different nonprofits that are selling things, and I often see canned goods there, home canned goods. Is there a way to know if they have been through a taste of summer class? Is there a sticker or something that they would put on their canned goods that helps me know that it was done properly?
Well, no, there is not any symbol or anything for knowing if they went through it properly. But there are some signs of telling if it was properly canned or if it was canned properly. And so making sure there's no bulging of the tops and looking at color and paying attention to color of the product. Of course, those are just, we can't tell if there's bacteria present or what's going on, but those are the symbols that or signs that we really look for when we talk about canned food safety, because a lot of these bacteria we're worried about produce gas and really break down the fruit or vegetable, whichever is within the canned good. So just using those signs, and if it doesn't smell right, and things like that will help. But there's no way to know if they've done it properly or not.
How about you, Angela? Do you buy canned goods from bazaars and things
yes,
like that?
Yes, I do. And people always ask me in my field. I go to farmers market. I'm a supporter of local foods. I believe that we need to grow up our communities. And so I am a person that goes out and I get all my fruits and veggies and I get all my jams and jellies and all of that. So it hasn't scared me yet.
All right. And another question for you. This one's from Anne Marie. I have a small city garden. Sometimes I see animal feces in the garden. I suspect it's raccoon, but what about squirrel or rabbit? How do I safely get the contaminants out of my garden?
Well, we know that they're going to be present, so there's no way of getting around that. It's just a matter of knowing if it's right by or on your produce, then that's one that you're just going to want to discard. We know that all types of feces, from raccoons and all that, they do contain harmful bacteria. So we just want to be mindful of walking through and seeing, even if we see deer or what have you, and not harvesting that product right that's directly on it or right by it, because it could be a contamination. So,
all right. And let's go back to the phones. Mary's on the line in Lakeview. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I would like to know if ice plant will grow in Iowa.
What again, please?
Ice plant. I've got a bank in my front yard that I'd like to cover with ground cover so I don't have to mow it.
Yeah. Not as a permanent addition. We can grow it, but sometimes it tends to be too wet and humid, and it kind of dies out. So it tends not to be a permanent addition.
All right. Mary, thanks a lot for your call. And we've got, let's see, Brian up next, somewhere on I-35. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. I was calling to see, I heard that rock salt could be used around asparagus as a weed killer. Is that true?
Well, that used to be used in the past where they would put on salt. We don't recommend it. It is true that asparagus is somewhat salt tolerant, but some weeds are salt tolerant too, so it doesn't necessarily control all weeds. And the other thing is, if you put on too much salt, eventually you get to a point where you harm the asparagus. So we don't recommend salt. We do recommend, unfortunately, hoeing and hand pulling. For the homeowner, that's the best way of doing it. There aren't very many herbicides labeled for use on asparagus in a home garden, and so your herbicide options are quite limited. So it's basically hoeing and hand pulling for the most part.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Brian. Next up, Gary in Eldora. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, kind of in line with what you just answered, I'm wondering if I can safely apply preen around asparagus or strawberries and know that it's not going to be absorbed into the fruit. Can I safely do that?
Okay, there are a number of preen products. One contains corn gluten meal, which is a corn milling byproduct, and that's perfectly safe to use in the garden. You can use that on strawberries or asparagus. The other preen product that you commonly see contains trifluralin, and you can use that on asparagus if you check the label, and you want to check the label always when you use a herbicide. If you check the label, they say you can use that product on asparagus if you apply that before the spears begin to emerge in spring.
Okay.
As far as strawberries, I don't think trifluralin is labeled for use on strawberries. Check the label to make sure, but I don't think it is.
Okay, great.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Gary. And next up, Dave in Dubuque. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, can I plant tomatoes one year and the next year potatoes? Is there any problem there with planting those plants in the same place?
Well, they're actually related plants.
Okay.
Tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, and eggplant. And the concern is that they're all susceptible to some of the same diseases. So we would suggest not to put in something entirely different, some other plant family, like a cabbage or beans or carrots or radishes, something basically unrelated.
Okay. And should you wait for a couple of years, or could you do that? Is 1 year enough to wait to go back and plant tomatoes again and potatoes and so on?
Right. Ideally, you would wait 3 years or longer, ideally.
Oh.
But when you have a small garden, obviously that may not be realistic. So you do your best you can.
Okay.
So if you can wait 2 years, that would be great. At least 1 year, at least.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Dave. And let's get back to we've got a lot of email questions today. This is from Joel. I have chives that come back year after year, the year after Roundup application. How can I get rid of them? And if I've applied Roundup the year before, are they edible if they come up again?
Well, I would say as far as getting rid of them, be persistent, be patient. And I'd probably dig them up and destroy them as soon as they show up and do that repeatedly. As far as edibility, Boy, that's difficult to say. If they're healthy plants, that would tell me they did not absorb the Roundup. Otherwise, if they did, they would be sickly. If they look sickly or damaged, then no way. But if they appear to be perfectly healthy, that would suggest they didn't really absorb the Roundup.
Angela, did you have something you wanted to add there?
Well, I agree. The health of the plant is what you're really after. And if you see any signs of damage, then that means that the toxin has actually taken effect. So you don't want to consume that.
They are tenacious plants.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's another question for you, Angela. This is from Sarah on Facebook. I'm wondering if there's any difference in handling organic produce than conventionally grown produce in terms of food safety and storage.
There is no difference. I always, like I started off saying, bacteria don't see organic. They don't see conventional. They don't see, you know, some of these specialty. They just see food and water. So we don't see any significant difference from a food safety standpoint between organic and conventionally grown. And so E. coli likes it just the same. So there are no differences in recommendations.
All right. And let's go to our final phone call of the day. This is Steve in Des Moines. Hi, Steve.
How are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I have 10 acres of old timber. It's mostly hardwood. And I had a friend ask me or kind of recommend to grow ginseng. I didn't know if that would take in central Iowa or not.
Well, ginseng is actually native to Iowa. You see it in wooded areas. But I will say it's very difficult to grow as a crop. We find it in nature, but as far as growing it as a crop is very, very difficult to do. It's grown chiefly in Wisconsin as a crop. There are a number of ginseng growers in Wisconsin, but it is a very difficult thing to do. You will find some information on the Internet. I believe that might be from Wisconsin, maybe Penn State. So you can find some information on growing it, but it is a difficult crop to grow.
Difficult because?
Well, it takes several years before you get a crop, and you have to deal with maybe weeds or competition. Things like that in the wooded area. And so it's difficult to grow as a crop.
All right, Dave, good luck if you give it a try. Let us know how it turns out if you decide to go ahead with it. And here's an email from David. Am I too late to apply pre-emergent and fertilizer for this spring? I'd like to prevent crabgrass and dandelions.
In central Iowa, I would be shooting for basically now, next 2 weeks or so. In northern Iowa, you could probably go into the first week in May very easily.
All right. And a final question for today. This is from Jerry in Cedar Rapids. I currently have a large soft maple tree that has a large hollow that a squirrel lives in. Since that might compromise the structure of the tree, I plan to have it removed. I'd like to replace it with a tree to provide shade for my ranch-style house. I'd appreciate comments about a tulip tree for this area.
Tulip trees are interesting. They have a very distinctive leaf. A very distinctive flower, not very common in Iowa, but we can grow them. I would say that it needs a well-drained, moist soil, and it's a big tree potentially, so make sure it has plenty of space.
All right. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And let's have some spring weather for next Friday, okay?
I would like that.
All right. Horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension. Angela Shaw, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Thanks for being on the show and come back again sometime. Angela Shaw is an assistant professor of food safety at Iowa State University and with Iowa State University Extension. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on the show, the novel Beautiful Fools, a novel about Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.